If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Caroline Crampton, standing in for your regular host Helen Lewis, and this week, George Eaton, Raphael Baer, Ian Steadman and I talk about the Conservatives' new habit of erasing their own speeches from their website. I interview Adam Price, the writer of hit Danish political drama Borgen, and Ian Steadman tells me about a new exhibition at the Science Museum about the Large Hadron Collider. Team of George Eaton and Raphael Baer and our science and tech writer Ian Steadman to talk about a curious story that's emerged this week of the Conservative Party trying to erase some of their history from the internet. George, you've been covering this online for us. Explain what they've been doing.
Well, this was a story that broke actually on the website Computer Weekly, and it emerged that the Conservatives had taken the step of erasing all pre-2010 speeches and press releases, not just from their own site, but from the internet itself, from the Internet Archive, which is the largest public digital library. And of course, there's plenty that from before 2010 that the Conservatives have reason to hide. And the reason why it was such a blunder and a bad judgment is that, of course, everyone's immediate reaction was to draw attention to that. And so there's actually now far more focus on that than there was before.
The Barbara Streisand effect. Raph, why would they want to get rid of their own legacy?
Well, as George said, I think the concern is that people go back and look at things that were said in opposition and compare them to things that are said now, which is an entirely reasonable thing for people to do, whether with regards to Barbara Streisand or David Cameron. There is an obsession at the very top of the government in number 10 that comes from the Prime Minister about the fear of what he calls split-screen moments, which are the things where in a campaign you can divide one half of the TV screen showing someone saying, for example, I promise there will be no more pointless top-down reorganisations of the NHS, and then on the other side, effectively showing him a couple of years later saying, behold my brilliant pointless top-down reorganisation of the NHS, or something to that effect. And there's tons of them, and frankly, it affects all politicians, but you know, no, we won't raise VAT, we won't means test child benefits, we just love the environment, oh, hang on, no, actually we will want to scrap all green taxes. Whatever it is, there's a huge range of things that were said, chiefly from the very early years of Cameron's leadership, when it was all about modernisation, reassuring people that he could make the Conservatives a sort of a soft-hearted liberal party, which is just politically not where they are now at all. It's not where he is. And the most dangerous charge for David Cameron in any campaign isn't that he is wrong about things or believes the wrong things, but that he doesn't believe anything at all, that he'll say anything. Because that's something that the right wing of the Conservative Party says about him, just as the left say it's about him. And the problem is, it's broadly speaking, it appears to be true. It's a very resonant charge. So if you can see why they would want to just make it harder for people to assemble those split-screen moments.
So, Ian, you've explained this to me very well. Is it even possible to delete things from the internet like this?
In a manner of speaking, yes. You can always delete things off your own website, which is the first thing they did. But as George said, there's the Internet Archive, which is a very useful site that kind of crawls through the entire web, making copies of sites, taking snapshots at regular intervals as a sort of public, non-profit archival sort of organisation. And But it's very easy to get stuff taken off there because, so to get technical, every website has a document in its source code called robot.txt, which tells things like Google which parts of the website should appear in search results and which parts shouldn't. And you can also get the in our archive. They have policies that they look at that document and they say, oh, you want this part of your site to be publicly accessible through search, third-party search sites, and other parts not to be. And because the Internet Archive is well aware that a lot of people don't want their websites archived for all time because it could be embarrassing or whatever, they're perfectly happy to, if you tell them as they're automatically searching through that they don't, like, you don't want your website to be sort of snapshotted, they won't do it. And you can also tell it to delete all past records. And that's basically what the Conservative Party have done. They've put in a line of text in the code very deliberately that just says, we want you to stop recording everything that's on the site and delete everything that already exists. Now, to say that they've deleted it off the web isn't true in the sense that there are copies on other blogs and news sites and stuff around the web, but the point is it's not in one central location. It makes research a lot harder and more time-consuming, which is really going to be what the aim is.
So this isn't something that you can do by accident. This is a deliberate
act. I'd say that you'd have to be... you could do it by accident in an extremely unlikely sense that you copied the code and put it in without knowing what it did. Mm. I really don't see how you could... It's not likely that it was by accident.
And how do we feel about this, George, this idea that a political party can erase its own history in the hope that no one will remember what they said?
Well, I think... it's wrong in principle because there are actually a lot of political academics, researchers who want this information simply for the record, for books or papers they're writing. Anyone who's engaged in politics should obviously want to encourage as much access to this material for academic purposes as possible. But I also think it's wrong as a political judgment because, you know, in the age of Google, in the age mass access to broadband and smartphones, as Ian says, you can never erase anything from the internet. It will always be there. And actually, the Conservatives haven't had as much of a bad rap over their broken promises as Nick Clegg has with your tuition fees. But actually, if you go back and look at how explicit Cameron was about them saying, you know, we have no plans to raise VAT, I'm happy, I want to keep universal child benefit, it's actually even more egregious than Clegg. And you know, I think now the Tories are beginning to feel some of the backlash from that they've been sort of bizarrely insulated from since the election.
I think it's interesting that one of the things that I saw, I mean, George is absolutely right, this has drawn a lot of people's attention to the fact that there are these sort of extreme contrasts between the various positions that Cameron and Osborne have held. And actually, it was some of the right-wing blogs and commentators yesterday afternoon were picking up on the segment of video that someone unearthed saying, with George Osborne saying, we will match, I think the words were, this means we will be spending just the same amount as the Labour Party and spending on public services will go up in real terms. I mean, it's absolutely there in black and white. Now, that is a fantastic kind of split-screen moment. So obviously, just politically, it's backfired. I do think it reveals something interesting about the way that Cameron and Osborne as a team have worked. It's something when you speak to Lib Dems in government, one of the things that they are have been most surprised about dealing with Cameron and Osborne is what they describe as the kind of frictionless movement across the ideological spectrum. They will, they really will say or do whatever the moment sort of demands, and they're fantastically good. Osborne in particular, fantastically good at kind of chutzpah. He doesn't expect any kind of intellectual consistency from himself or the people around him. And it surprises Labour as well. The left always craves a certain kind of systematic programme that you have beliefs and somehow that informs what you do. You can then be a hypocrite if the sort of tactics require it, but they presume that everyone has some base level of sort of intellectual coherence from which they might deviate in an emergency. What they're realising is that Cameron, they don't have that. They, as I say, they sort of don't believe anything. And it's very disorienting for their opponents, but it gets exposed when this sort of thing happens.
George, how much of this is the Conservatives starting to gear up towards the next election?
Oh, they're completely in campaign mode already. And you actually see that with a lot of the policies they announced, so-called policies on health tourism, benefit tourism. I mean, they're not really sort of designed to have a significant effect on life in Britain, mainly because they won't be implemented for some time. They're really designed to send a signal to particular parts of the electorate. You know, we get it. We're with you on immigration. We're with you on welfare. I would just say on speeches that it's interesting. You go back to the Labour side. The oldest speech on the side is Ed Miliband's first speech as Labour leader. Labour have done their own sort of streamline of the site. So the year zero was declared when Miliband was elected. There's sort of no speeches from Blair or Brown there, but presumably their wisdom was not to get caught.
Not to get caught, and to perhaps do it in a, you know, we've relaunched our website, we've redesigned it. This is just a whole rebranding exercise, as you say, not drawing attention to the fact that they're rewriting history.
Yeah, I think you can game the fact that people have no memory. Most people, the bottom line in all these things is most people aren't paying attention to politics at all. They don't really know what's going on. They couldn't identify anyone in the cabinet apart from the Prime Minister and maybe the Chancellor. They have no idea who any opposition politicians are. And they don't remember very much. It's just a big theme. So will the Tories kind of, in quotes, get away with this? Yes. But does it feed a broader sense that there's something essentially slippery about them, which plays to the worst of their brand? Yes, that too.
Thanks very much, Raph George and Ian. The third series of the Danish political drama Borgen starts in the UK on Saturday on BBC 4. I interviewed its writer, Adam Price, and I started off by asking him whether he always knew this was going to be the last series of the show. So the first episode airs on Saturday.
Yeah.
In the UK, and I understand this is going to be the last series.
It is.
Of Borgen. Was that always how it was intended to be, or is it a kind of commission?
Actually, we didn't think we were going to do a third series.
Oh really? Okay. Yeah. You thought you'd end with the second one.
Yes. That was the original plan. But then the series was quite successful in Denmark, and they thought, let's do a third. But they have a reasonably small drama production because Denmark is obviously a small country, and they don't produce that much. So it's really important to them that they cannot just press the button and say, you just go on and do as many as you like. And also they really challenge you. I mean, they challenged me anyway, and they said, now give us a good reason for commissioning a third. Tell us a story that is new around these characters, because I knew that we would probably be able to just do 10 more episodes in the state ministry, following the second season, but they wanted something more than that.
So I understand you've done something quite radical for a political drama, which is
extremely radical.
You've turned your central character into an ex-politician.
Exactly. Yes.
And so she's become, I suppose, what we'd understand in this country as a kind of Tony Blair figure.
You could say that, doing the lecture circle and
directorships. And
exactly.
Kind of thing,
exactly. Yeah. Yes. Because I thought the interesting question, dramatic question to ask was, what would happen if she actually lost the election that she announces in the final episode of the second season? What would she do? And for many politicians today, they leave politics when they lose, because they don't really see an afterlife as the former prime minister, now head of opposition. It's kind of, no, that's it, I'll leave. And then, so to start her off as far away from politics as possible, and then ask the second question, what would drag her into politics again?
And because I think in the first series, what kind of certainly really engaged me about Peter was her kind of idealism, but the way she managed to actually reconcile that with what she had to do.
Yeah.
Day to day. And I suppose it's that spark of idealism that you recapture here.
It is, definitely. And I think that goes through in her character all the way through all three series. And it is very important because, I mean, even though that the series actually in some terms takes her from idealism, a bit towards cynicism or realism anyway. She still needs, as a character, to retain that sparkle of idealism.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
She actually believes in what she does. She's not only a pragmatic politician.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. I think that's perhaps part of what's made it feel seductive.
Yes.
To the audience.
Yes. Yeah. But that's also definitely what I wanted, because I didn't want to tell a political story where all the politicians were shits, basically, you know, and just devious bastards that were kind of self-sufficient and only wanted power for the sake of power. Because that, I thought, we would not be able to write not even 10 episodes of that, because it would just be evil. So I really thought, and also that story had been told, even in Denmark, in several feature films, very successful feature films, where it was the conscientious journalists that had to bring down the evil politician. And I thought, no, let's try to do something else. Let's try to say, this is a world that's populated by some shits, but also some, well, not saints, but actually people that want to do good. Sometimes they do good in a bad way, but they at least their intentions were good, to give us a flicker of hope. So I think even at its darkest, in Borgen, there's always a flicker of hope. That is perhaps the nature of the show.
And when you first started out, when you were first talking about doing the first series, did you have any idea that people all over the world would be fascinated by it?
Not at all. Even, I mean, we were told by the then head of drama, Mr. Ingolf Garbold. He said, "Now, boys, you have to kind of get to terms with this show will not travel."
Not like The Killing or something like that.
Not at all. No. This show is a strictly Danish show because, I mean, who would want to see a Danish show about coalition politics? I mean, and we kind of agreed to that and said, well, yeah. And he said, well, perhaps the Swedes and Norwegians will buy it out of brotherly love or something, but that would be it.
I did one of the first episodes that I really, really got hooked on was the formation of the coalition in the first episode. And at the end, I think the second episode, I found myself thinking, why am I so completely gripped by a small country that I don't know anything about trying to horse
to form a government?
No,
exactly.
Why, how
no.
have you done that? And I think I don't think I'm alone in that.
No.
But so the fact that it has travelled to...
It has now. We have sold it to 75 countries.
75
So.
And it's, I mean, in Britain it's shown with subtitles, but in other countries
it's amazing.
Dubbed,
it stopped in France, it's dubbed in Germany, I'm sure it stopped in Italy as well, and other places, I'm sure it is. But, I mean, we are amazed that you actually air it in Danish in the UK.
Well, I suppose maybe it helps that we have enjoyed other Danish
Scandinavian
dramas.
Yes.
That we're sort of, we know it's okay, we know we can still enjoy it, even if we don't understand it.
Yeah.
But has the fact that it's travelled like that changed at all your process or how you write?
No, it hasn't. I mean, also, it came relatively late. I mean, we were at the end of the shooting, I think, the second season, when it began to sell.
I see. So.
And basically, we just thought, let's stick to what we've actually been told from the very beginning. Just do the show you want to do, and I mean, don't try to listen to all that beautiful noise of people getting interested in the thing you're actually writing. Try to just stick to the story, and I think we really tried to do that.
And I think I'm right to say it's been popular in Denmark as well, obviously.
Yes.
Has there been much kind of interaction with Danish politics? You know, do you have politician fans?
Quite a lot, and I mean, I must say, when we come now to the third season, it reached a level that was unheard of. I'll say that One of the episodes that you're going to see in the third season, it actually, the way Birgitte Nyborg deals with a certain subject actually turned into a proposal made in the Danish parliament by one of the real parties. Yeah.
So informed
and they were, it was discussed. And I mean, of course, there was a huge controversy in the real Danish political, debate that, my God, are you getting now inspiration from a fiction show? I mean, very interesting. And of course, we were just, having a field day in the writers' room. We were just going, my God, how wonderful.
It must be a sort of TV writer's dream to see what you've written actually happen in real life.
Exactly. Yeah. Life, exactly, imitating art.
Well, I know when the first and the second series was on in the UK, I know everyone who works in Parliament is a massive fan of all the political journalists, and there was quite a lot of discussion that, why couldn't our coalition formation that we had in 2010, why couldn't it have been more like Borg and it looked so much more fun?
Yeah.
than what we did, where there was an awful lot of standing outside in the rain and just then people coming out and telling us what happened.
But the interesting thing is that of course we cannot take credit for, I know we had our first female prime minister after we kind of introduced in the series. Of course, that is a complete coincidence. But the government that Ms. Helle Thorning-Schmidt has actually put together is a coalition which resembles exactly
the mix of
parties in Borgen, which is just interesting. And they are really having a difficult time. I mean, the Danish government is fighting its way through an unheard of crisis. I mean, really, really, really. With the polls as bad as that, you would...
That really shows, I suppose, how realistic and how spot on you were with your analysis.
Well, I think we developed a talent for guessing, but it is mere guessing. But obviously, we also chose our subjects out of what we knew was kind of explosive in the debate. We knew that they would probably also be discussing this at the time when we will air this particular episode. So,
And you mentioned the fact that Denmark now has its first female prime minister. The role of women in the show is something that's been talked about an awful lot.
Yes, yes.
And was that, as you say, something deliberate, kind of explosive, provocative?
Well, it was. No, in Denmark it is not viewed upon as something very provocative, because I do believe that we're actually a bit more progressive over
in our
country.
I think everyone
here would agree with that. Yeah. We're kind of used to strong women, and I think it's been very important for us in the writer's room that after a while we don't point our finger at Birgitte Nyborg all the time and says she's a woman, and remember she's a woman. She's a character. She's our hero. She happens to be a woman. We don't really care. She's a woman with all that wonderful vulnerability and fragility that Sisse puts into that part, and she does that in an unheard of beautiful way. I'm really applauding her all the time, because she lifts the part up to a level I wouldn't have dreamt of. But I think actually it is not so exotic in Denmark with these strong women as it probably is here. And I know it is also in France. I've participated in several debates in France, and they're very much like, I've been put on stage with four feminists. And I felt at home there.
This week has been to the opening of a new exhibition at the Science Museum, which I think I'm right in saying is called Collider.
It's called Collider.
Which is about the Large Hadron Collider and the discovery of the Higgs boson.
It is, yes. It's a really nice, lovely exhibition about the history of particle physics, really. But in a way that's not as dry as that sounds. Like, the director of the Science Museum described it as like a meaty exhibit with real objects, as opposed to fake objects, I don't know, but it's got some sort of cross-sections of these massive tubes that they fire protons through, and it's very dramatic. Go see it. But Peter Higgs was there, who the Higgs boson is named after, and it was nice seeing him. He was at this press conference, and it was funny seeing him, because it kind of confirmed, you know, he was on holiday when he won the Nobel Prize and no one could get hold of him because he was on a beach somewhere. And like, I totally got that impression in real life as well, that he was a little bit baffled by the fame that he'd received. Mm-hmm. He was talking a lot about, you know, people asking about this Nobel win. And he was very keen to point out that in the 60s, when he was writing about this boson and theorizing whether it existed, there were three groups. There was him, there were two scientists in Brussels, at the University of Brussels, and there were three scientists at Imperial College, including a British scientist called Tom Kibble, who's still at Imperial. And the Nobel Prize Committee decided, because you can only have three people every year, apparently.
That's just their arbitrary rule.
Yeah, it's like no more than three people. The first three, which were the two in Brussels and Peter Higgs, were going to be the ones who received it. One of the men from Brussels has passed away, so only two people got it. And he said, well, Tom Kibble, or at least some other people should have, because, you know, it was a collaborative thing where the total sum of our work was what led to the prediction, not just, you know, it being named after me. And it's interesting that Collider really celebrates the fact that there are, you know, 10,000 people working at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland, Austria. They're working together, and it's 10,000 people together who collaborated to find the Higgs boson. But you can't really give 10,000 people the Nobel Prize, because that's not how it works.
It's not how it works, because that's how it's always worked. But yeah, science has changed and the prize hasn't.
It has, yeah. You don't really get... when the Nobel Prize was set up in all the different fields that it's given away in, it's all about recognising individual acts of genius, that kind of like Einsteinian figure, because that's... It's meant to popularise science in a way, and, well, literature and stuff like that. So it focuses on people that the public can recognise a name. You know, there's like, this is the Nobel laureate, that's the thing. But you can't give that to 10,000 people, because that'll water it down. But science doesn't work like that anymore. And I do think it's ridiculous that you can get like the Nobel Prize for Peace given to the EU, but you can't give like a prize to CERN at the organisation or something, because that's really what the deserving winner would have been.
But I suppose it does help non-scientists such as myself that it's named after a person I can see talking on television.
Yeah, it does. But if you look through the people who have won it over the last sort of 20 years, the discoveries become increasingly like esoteric and difficult for the layperson to understand. Mm. It's no longer people like, you know, everyone knows Marie Curie. And everyone can kind of understand, with a basic understanding of physics, what Marie Curie did and why it was groundbreaking. Whereas now you look at people who have won the Nobel Prize, and it's for very complicated discoveries, which are very important, but which are part of a larger collaborative scientific process involving communication between people on other sides of the world, in journals and stuff, and reliant on the work of so many other people who don't go credited, that it just doesn't seem fair in the same way. There's no such... in the Collider exhibit, they have some of the earliest experiments on things like photons and electrons and stuff. And, you know, in the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century, you could have someone like Ernest Rutherford doing experiments with one lab assistant in Manchester on a table in a laboratory with one piece of equipment. And those two people could do everything that they need to do. And that's now got to the stage where you need 10,000 people. Mm. It doesn't work the same.
Yeah, very, very interesting. This week's podcast was presented by me, Caroline Crampton, with Raphael Baer, George Eaton, Ian Steadman and Adam Price. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. The podcast was produced by me and edited by Philip Morn. More details on how to subscribe can be found at newstatesman.com/podcast. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.